Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give, and there's no regular commitment. Just click the link in the show description to support now.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Fiction. Science fiction. Horror. Fantasy. Crime. LGBT. Thriller.
You have now entered the House of Mystery with your hosts, Eric Shapiro, David North Martino, John Copenhaver, and Al Warren.
Heard on 106.5 FM Los Angeles,
102.3 FM Riverside,
and 105.0 AM Palm Springs.
Welcome back into the House of Mystery, and we are now on daylight savings time. Disgusting. And I'm still in a fog. It's torture.
It certainly is, Al.
It's your fault.
It is. It's always my fault.
Yeah, why did you make us change the time? I have to blame you. I have to blame someone.
I just like to cause trouble.
I know. I'm going to have to speak to your wife. Get her, tone you down some. My.
I know. Somebody's got to.
It's too much work, Keep you locked in the basement.
That's right.
Your cat.
That's where I belong.
Yeah, I didn't say it. Now you're learning. You're learning.
That's right. I know my place.
You know your place. Well, and I saw your new movie review up. It looks good.
Oh, thank you.
Yeah, I guess a lot of people are commenting. It was kind of a take it or leave it movie. That was okay.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And did you see Eric, our other co-host? He put up his rating he got on a movie he made.
Oh, did he? I missed that.
He put up two ratings. He got a 5-star from someone saying how good it was and all this stuff. And then he got a 1-star from someone saying that it's left is BS. Oh, I got to love it. You got to love people, anyway.
It's all part of the fun.
Yeah, it certainly is, well, now, today we've got another one, Bites the Dust. We've got a fantasy author. And he comes from Canada in the big white north back east. So let's talk to him, Mr. Richard H. Stevens. Thank you for being here.
Hi, Alan. Hi, David. Thanks for having me.
Oh, it's a pleasure. It's a pleasure. So this is interesting. You've written quite a few fantasy books over the years here, it looks like. What got you into this writing world? Like, where did it start for you?
I started writing when I was about 9 years old. In Canada, we have 2 month summer vacation from school. And probably one hot August morning, I was sitting around bored stiff. And I had a Hardy Boys book sitting next to me. And I'm thinking, I could probably write a story like that. So I did. And I changed out Frank and Joe Hardy and made them myself and my best friend. And we solved some mysteries. And then in 1977, I saw Star Wars at the theaters. And I was smitten by science fiction. So I wrote a 600-page science fiction book with, again, myself and my friends going around saving the galaxy. And then in about 1980, 81, a local bookstore proprietor introduced me to the book The Sword of Shannara by Terry Brooks. And I was hooked on fantasy at that point, and my writing changed to fantasy as well. And then late 1982, the song Run to the Hills by Iron Maiden came on the radio one night. and for some reason, it just sparked this fantasy story in my head, the Soulforge saga. And it was supposed to be a 3-book series. And 36 years later, Soulforge Book 1 in the Soulforge universe was released in 2018.
So Running to the Hills, kind of classic song in the metal world back then. So are you kind of doing fantasies that are people are in trouble?
Yeah, well, the protagonist in Soulforge, he's actually a washed-up hero, so he doesn't start young. He starts, you're introduced to him, he's 45 years old, and he's an alcoholic, and he wants nothing to do with the world. Well, he was out saving the kingdom from the evil sorcerer many, many years before. No one stuck around to save his family, so when he came back, he found his family was dead, and he became a recluse, and he was a real sad character when we come upon him at the beginning of Soulforge. But for those 35 years that book languished in my head, I had 2 careers and 5 children, and they always take precedence over what I want to do as an author. But I always knew the ending to this trilogy. And halfway through book 3, when I was writing in 2019, Into the Madness, one of the main characters who was supposed to be integral to the end of the story did something so bizarre that the ending was gone, and I had to come up with a new ending, and a dragon came into the story. So at that point, I thought, that's great. So for 1,000 pages, there's no mention of a creature that's the size of a house. And now we have one in the book. And I'm going to have to explain this to my readers who read book 1 and 2, why there was no mention of a dragon up to this point. So I went back in time and I wrote the Rika's Flight series, Legends of the Lurker, and it explains where the dragons went. And while I was writing that, the book that we want to talk about today is Keeper of the Jewel. I had mentioned the 700-year-old Elf Queen. And as I was writing that story, I'm thinking, I'd love to write the story of the 700-year-old Elf Queen. So I did not George R. R. Martin my series. I finished it. And then I went back in time several hundred years before that and started writing The Rise of the Elf Queen. And that's where the Keeper of the Jewel comes into play.
700-year-old Elf Queen. You could have just wrote my story.
But she's not 700 and is actually a 17-year-old spoiled princess who is enjoying the posh castle life. And when her mother discovers a plot to assassinate the princess, the queen exiles the princess to a rock that's protected by dragons. And she figures it's the best thing for her daughter. And of course, the princess is not too happy about that.
No. I wouldn't be either. I'm spoiled. I have everything I want. Yeah. Why would I want to go to a rock?
You two can relate for sure. Yeah.
Yeah. Big girl. Hey, listen. So I wonder when you write these characters, so you've got the dark alcoholic, you've got the spoiled princess, you've got all these different characters like that. How do you put yourself into their place and write their feelings and their experiences and that without you being that? Or do you dress up like a princess and kind of go do that thing? Or like, where does this come from? Is this just your imagination? And
yeah, it wouldn't be pretty if I dressed up as a princess, I'll tell you that right now. But generally when I first started Soulforge, I opened the door. I'm not a planner, I'm not a plotter, so I don't think out things ahead of time. I opened up front door, I kicked the alcoholic out the door, and we discovered the world through his eyes. So it was, I was kind of along as a viewer or a reader as well. So I didn't know what was going to go on. I always knew where the story was going to end. And then it didn't end there anyway, but I always knew where it was going to end for 35 years. And I just had to discover the world through his eyes. So as we walked through the forest, I described them, and the reader and myself got familiar with the land of Zephyr. So, but with regards to their feelings and stuff like that, it's just, I don't know, I've been around for 50 odd years now, so I've experienced all these different things. I used to work in a police service, so, I've seen a lot of things as well, and, I can kind of relate to a lot of these scenarios. I've never been a spoiled princess before, but I know I've seen spoiled children, and, I just try to visualize how they would react and how they would speak. So even though it's a fantasy world, I try to put the real life elements in it just to make my characters more relatable to everyday life.
Well, with your characters,
that are more like mythological, like elves and dragons and such. Do you use the standard characterizations of those characters, or are you going for something that is more unique to your worldview for your fantasy worlds?
I would say I kind of stay down the center there. You know, an elf is an elf is an elf. If it quacks like a duck, it's a duck. So my elves are a little, a little snooty. They're a little higher than everyone else. And, you know, they live so long, so their intelligence is much higher than man, who lives maybe 50, 60, 70 years, depending on what they do in the world. But so elves gain this little bit of hierarchy where they're a little bit more knowledgeable, and they consider themselves a little bit more worthy than man. So there is a bit of a rivalry there. And so, you know, the mankind's always looking at the pointy ears people, and there's a bit of prejudice going on in there. As far as dragons, I don't know if there is a typical dragon. Like we think of the James Bond guy. Jeez, I can't remember the white beard and all that with a great voice. He did the dragon, Dragonheart.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
I can't think of his name, but James Bond at one point. Sean Connery. When Sean Connery.
Oh, Sean Connery. Yes, yes.
It's great getting old because you forget all these things. But so when Sean Connery did that, you know, he plays a very intelligent dragon who's, kind of looks down upon mankind as well. And I think dragons are always portrayed that way if they're given some kind of sentience. So I'd say my characters basically stick to the norms.
Your characters, when you say I always talk to fiction writers like yourself and fantasy writers. Your characters, how do you feel about them, and what kind of relationship do you have them and with them? And I ask that because I hear so many fiction writers saying stuff like their family or their children or their, you know, some sort of description of a close member to them and that. So how is it for you?
Yeah, it's interesting you say that. You know, I don't consciously view them that way. They're just something I write down on a piece of paper, but you do grow an affinity to them, that's for sure. I have a few characters that their time in the story had come, and I fought very hard whether they should actually die or not. And because, you know, I'd grown so used to them being in my story, they were just like a close friend you have beside you. Your pet dog or cat is always with you, and all of a sudden it's time for them to go. So it's very hard sometimes to get rid of them. You know, even if you do it as an author to give some impact to the story, some emotion to the story, I find that when I go back and edit these scenes, it really emotionally bothers me as well to see them go. And my narrator, he was reading into the Wizard of the North. No, sorry, he was reading into the Madness. And this is where that one character does something so bizarre. And the scene brought him to tears. And he's a narrator from the U.S. who really has nothing invested in the story other than he wants his voice to sound well, so maybe we'll sell a few books. But so it was neat, the emotional impact that he had. So, yeah, as an author, I find it hard to get rid of some characters. I find it easy to get rid of others. Like, some are built to get rid of, but some of the characters you get really close to.
Well, you said you've had characters surprise you. I'm wondering how you experience your characters. Do you have an inner monologue in your head? Is that how you write dialogue? I guess I'm trying to find out if you're hearing voices, too. So.
I know that it just happens. Like I say, as a pantser who is a writer who flies by seat of his pants for the most part, I don't have things planned out. And so when the scene starts and they start talking, a lot of times I don't know what they're going to be talking about until we have the conversation. And they do surprise me. And I don't know what I'm going to write. I don't sit down thinking, okay, he's going to say this. But that being said, as I get more involved, I've got 13 books now, and they're all in the same universe. So I start making points and different pieces of paper and stuff like that. So I know where some stories will go in the future just because of things that I've divulged out of some of the characters I'm writing now. But generally for the conversations themselves, I don't know how the conversation's going to go.
And you said you worked for the police service for a while, so I would imagine there was a lot of structure in your job. So it's kind of funny that you don't like to do outlines, or you're not really an outliner or a planner too much. It's natural to go the other way. So how do you know how many books you're going to do in a series and stuff like, or I guess you don't, right? It's just totally as it comes.
Yeah, I generally I don't know why, but I generally write in trilogies. This last series with Keeper of the Jewel. Keeper of the Jewel was never supposed to be written. I include interior pictures of my books. And so I try to find them cheap from designers. And I saw a cover designer who had the Keeper of the Jewel cover on there. And I inboxed her and said, hey, I'd like to use that for an interior picture. And she said, absolutely not. And I said, okay. She said, it's too good to be an interior picture. I'm selling it as a cover. So, I thought that was kind of neat because she's making money, the same kind of money, regardless what I do with that picture. But she stuck to her guns. And I thought about it for, about a week. And all of a sudden, I had a 600-page book jump into my head. And I figured I was just going to start the Highcliffe Guardians a little bit earlier and start the story with the princess being 17 instead of where I was going to start her at the time. And, that's how that went.
How much of you are you putting into the book, into these characters? I mean, how much of your own, let's say, personality or feelings or thoughts in that way go into these characters?
I think probably a lot. I don't think I consciously do it, but I think as an author, you don't have a choice. Like, you're writing from your own experience. You can't write from Alan's experience or David's experience. I can't anyway, because I haven't experienced what you guys have. So I think as authors, whether we consciously or subconsciously do it, our characters and our stories even are basically an extension of ourselves. So, there are a lot of things that you go through in life that that will weigh on you. And whether you constantly think about them at the time or not, they will seep into your story. So I guess my character relations and things that they go through, kind of, even though it's, again, even though it's a fantasy world, I try to relate them back to today's world then, so the reader can sympathize, empathize, get angry with, or not to like my point of view, but it's my point of view. So that's how the story is going to be written. So there will be some readers that maybe the themes in my books don't agree with them, but I can't please everybody. So.
No. And you use them and kill them in your next book.
That's a great part about being a writer. That's correct.
Yeah. You can take anybody you don't like. So I wonder then, do you think there's a subtext that comes out of your book? Is there some sort of a meaning and more than just the story itself? And it might not even be planned. It might be something that just comes out. Are you trying to get something across to the reader?
Yeah, for sure. Every time I write a book, I'm always trying to come across some of the moral dilemmas that our world faces. One of my books, it's just a short little novella. It's actually the very first thing I ever published. And I did not have a professional editor for this one. It's just a little short story about the characters when they're younger. I was just trying to cut my teeth, learning Amazon and all that stuff, trying to figure out how to actually self-publish myself. And so I wrote this little story called The Royal Tournament. And it's about this young man who is always helping his father out. He can't escape the farm life. He wants to go fight with the king, but he's tied to his family. He can't let his father down. And he comes across a person of color. And in my world, in Zephyr, there aren't a lot of people of color there. But this person of color comes in there. And of course, he gets discriminated against, like we've seen through the way our Earth is, unfortunately. And so it turned, and I never meant to write the book along those lines. That just happened while the story was developing. And all of a sudden, I had this really emotional bond between these two totally different people who come together. They don't know each other, but they're both naive and they're both innocent. And they don't see each other for being black and white. They see each other as people. And so I like that too. Growing up, my best friends were all from all over the world, and I never saw them as anything else other than people. So I guess I'm not a good person to champion the cause of anything like that, but I'm just telling the story from my point of view. And I think if I tried to get on a soapbox and start preaching, I would probably get it all wrong. So I try not to do that. But it does come through in my stories for sure. I just, the world would be a better place if we just accepted everybody as a person and not whatever other perceptions we have of them.
Yeah, that's kind of, it's an endless fight, it seems like.
Sure. And there's really no right answer. It's, because as soon as you weigh in one way, someone's going to tell you something else. So.
Well, you got to live your life and kind of go, well, this is how I like it. This is how I see it. And that's kind of what you do. Forget everyone. Well, kill them in your book, too.
And don't do harm to anyone else. And and let people live the way they want to live, as long as they're not harming anyone else. And, you know, I don't see where the issue is, because we're only here for a short time. It's not a, we don't get a dress rehearsal and come back and do it right the next time. Like, we get one shot at this, so why don't we just live
on? I agree, totally, except for with David. We got to keep him.
That's true.
It gets a little
I'm learning this about Dave. So.
he's one to be careful. So I wonder, because when you do this, and so you've done that book, for instance, and every other one, how does it affect you? Like, what do you get out of a book? So when you've completed a book like that, where you know there's a kind of a meaning to it, and something that is kind of more below the entertainment value in the story, and you've shared that and you put that in a book and you look back at it, how do you think it changes you?
I don't know if it changes me. What I would like is, I hope that the readers that enjoy my stories actually will get something out of it. It's not really a message that I'm trying to say. It's just, I'm just trying to portray my characters as you see them in everyday life here on Earth. And, I think if I can get the reader to empathize with them, not feel sorry, that's the wrong way. And it's funny, when I do these interviews as an author, I should know all these words, but when I try to actually articulate them live here, it doesn't quite come out as well as it should. I can write it better and I can say it, but I just hope that the reader will take something away from it and go, well, you know what, I agree with that, and that it leaves an impression in them so that they'll think about it a bit longer and think, you know, I really enjoyed that story because of the way the characters interacted, because of the way they dealt with certain situations, and I wish the world would be like that in real life.
Oh, absolutely. Well, you've written a lot, and I'm just wondering if you've noticed any motifs or recurrent themes within your work.
Other than Monty Python eggs that I try to put out through them, my son is one of my beta readers, and I like to throw them in there just for him to find, and it's just a flesh wound. It would be a common one that you'd know, but I just throw them in there once in a while. And but as far as recurrent themes, I don't think so. I think each of my stories develops its own theme. And again, I don't sit down. And I know some writers do. They try to put a certain theme in there, or do racism this time, or do alcoholism, or whatever, and then they try and expand upon that. I don't. I think these things happen in everyday life all the time. So sometimes a great mixture of these things will come into my stories. Sometimes a lot, sometimes a little. It all depends on what's happening with the adventure and the quest that my characters and creatures are on. So I never consciously try to put them in there, but they do seep in there, because I try to make the characters realistic, like that we can all relate to. So they're going to have their foibles as well. You know, they're going to do some great things, and they're going to do some things that they're not quite proud of. So,
you know, when you talk about things seeping in, like a lot of your life and relationship experiences through your life. So when you're writing, do things in the outside world affect you? Like, you know, the last couple of years has been crazy, all the weird stuff and, you know, the politics and the COVID and, you know, the truckers and everything going on. It creates a certain atmosphere. No matter what side you'd be on, there's a certain atmosphere, and there's this real, you know, kind of an ugliness sort of, and a real tension and upset going on. Does that stressor factor into your book?
Again, I don't think I consciously have it come into my books, but as a regular person, I don't think I can avoid that happening. So it's funny you say that. I had a research trip planned to the British Isles on May 4th, 2020, and I was supposed to research superstition witchcraft of the 15th and 16th century. And of course, that got canceled because of COVID. And so the series that I was going to write changed. So I queried my fans as to which minor character from my books that they've read would like to hear a story about. And COVID had started to settle in, and we didn't know where we were going. And it seemed like most of them wanted to hear about this young, cheeky archer named Sidira, who I mentioned in halfway through into the Wizard of the North, that she has a dark history, but I never tell them what it is. And they wanted to know what her dark history was. Oh, okay, I'll write that story. And I could see that the things that we were going through with COVID and the uncertainty of whether we'd ever come out of it again, you know, how serious was it? it all started coming into the story as far as the theme. Sierra's story is a very dark one at the beginning. And I tried to shine a bit of light in there as well. So like there was a light at the end of the tunnel type of thing. So Sierra's going through this very dark time, which COVID really was for many people. But, you know, I tried to put that little light at the end of the tunnel so that not everything was all doom and gloom, that, you know, if we persevere and fought through it, that, you know, perhaps maybe we might be able to get to that light again. So it certainly did prevail in the series I wrote during 2020, for sure.
Do you have like an occult sort of paranormal sort of, I don't know, belief, or has it entered your life to a point where you'd like to write about it or include it in your
book? Not at all. Not at all. No. Nope. And I don't mean to. It's funny, being a fantasy writer, I love all my fans. I get some fans that come in here into my booth or wherever I'm selling books and signing books, and you know, they tell me they're dragons and they tell me all these other things. And, you know, that's great. If that's what you believe and you're happy doing that, then that's fine. But I personally don't believe in ghosts. I don't believe in dragons and fairies and all this other stuff, but I believe in the escapism and the vehicle that it gives us to escape the everyday troubles and trials and tribulations that you might have in your everyday life. It doesn't have to be COVID. You know, we all have financial issues. We all have, people have financials, they have marital issues, they have relationship issues, whatever your issue is. I think reading a book is a nice way to escape it or dig deeper in it, depending on the theme that you're reading. But as far as fantasy goes, I think it's a nice way to just kind of disconnect with the troubles of the world at the time. And, you know, even if it's only for half an hour that you're engrossed in the pages, I think it's a nice vehicle for the reader to, just kind of take a time out.
So you don't dress up like a dragon or anything?
I do. I'm not a dragon. I'm not big enough. I'm not a big guy. So I dress up. I have a knight's costume that I wear when I go to a lot of like comic cons and stuff like that. And people absolutely love it. I'm a very reserved person. So for me to do that, it's really stepping out of my comfort zone. But it's something that you do as you try and help us as an independent author. You need something to get people into your booth. Because when people walk by Richard H. Stevens' booth, they'll look at the books and go, I don't know who that is. And they'll just keep going. You know, if it says Stephen King or J.K. Rowling on there, they'd be in there like shot. So I need something else to draw people in. So I will wear a knight's costume, and I'm okay with it now.
I was going to say, just put Stephen King on there. And a locking overhead button. Yeah, lock them in. And dress up like Stephen
King. There you go.
You know, you get them in there, and then they can't get out. They don't buy a book. You have like this big push a button and they go through the floor.
Yeah, I think they'd be a little disappointed if they came in and realized it'll be the
game. Yeah, well, you never know. You never know. So who are your inspirations? And it doesn't just have to be writers. Do you have some sort of influences or things that kind of...
If you're looking for plump lips that last, you need to know about Juvederm lip fillers. With Juvederm Volbella XC and Juvederm Ultra XC, your lip look, whether it's subtle or bold, can last up to one full year with optimal treatment and no additional maintenance. Find a licensed specialist and see if it's right for you at Juvederm.com today. That's Juvederm.com. Add fullness to lips in adults over 21 with Juvederm Volbella XC or Juvederm Ultra XC. Do not use if you have severe allergies or a history of severe allergic reactions, or if you're allergic to lidocaine or the proteins used in Juvederm. Tell your doctor if you have a history of scarring or taking medicines that decrease the body's immune response or that can prolong bleeding. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. As with all fillers, there's a rare risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. For full important safety information, visit Juvederm.com.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Get you going.
Yeah, let's see a few of my family members. My wife, she's set up her own online business, and she's fairly successful at it. She's actually successful enough that's allowed me to leave my job with the police service. I'm not a big strapping guy, nor am I an alpha male. So the police service probably wasn't the best choice of a career for me. I had a very hard time dealing with the individuals that we had to deal with. So I was stressed to the point that we figured my life might end prematurely. And so she's allowed me to actually step away from the policing life and just write full time. So she's a big inspiration there. My children are too, just because we didn't have a lot growing up, and the way they persevered and did very well in university. And we also, they did on their own, you know, as much as we wanted to help them, we couldn't at the time. And so they're an inspiration that way too. And one of my books is the two characters pretty well draw upon my one son and my one daughter, the 2 years apart. And the two characters, I can see them, my son and daughter, in those two characters when I wrote that series and how they interplay with each other. As far as authors go, Terry Brooks is the one who, like I said earlier, that he's the one who inspired my love of reading and writing fantasy. And Stephen R. Donaldson, his world building is absolutely incredible. So he's the one who also made me fall in love with the genre.
Well, what about someone that is world building? It makes it spectacular. What special thing is there?
Just the ease at which he can make you feel transported into a place that's not Earth. And that's, you know, fantasy is, the books are so big, and a lot of that has to do with the world building, the magic systems and everything else like that. That's so if I say, you know, we're going to Paris, France, that's all I have to say. Everyone knows what Paris, France is. I don't have to, you know, elaborate on that. As a fantasy writer, if I say we're going to Grishin, you haven't got a clue where that is. So I got to tell you where it is, and you know, I got to explain what it looks like and the geographic areas around it. And for some authors, you know, sometimes you have pages and pages and pages of this stuff, and you go, oh my God, like, move on with the story. But for Stephen R. Donaldson and the more prolific good fantasy authors, they can do it in very few words and transport you on top of this high mountain overlooking this very steep defile with a river running down at the bottom, and there's something going down there, and you know, it start piquing your curiosity as a reader. And they can do it in so few words that you don't even realize that someone's actually just narrating what you're seeing. You're actually seeing it, and you're living the story. So I think that's what I really enjoy with Stephen R. Donaldson. He does become very long-winded as the series progresses, and I find a lot of authors do that, but I really enjoyed his stuff.
Well, I'm curious too. You know, you mentioned that you were on the police force and such, and I find it interesting. Is it your love of fantasy itself that made you go toward being a fantasy writer? Since you have police experience that could be put in a thriller book, or is it just that you don't like you didn't like your experiences on the police?
No, that's exactly right. At the end there, a lot of people ask me, and I wish I, looking back, I wish I had written down a lot of things that I've seen. And it's truth is a lot stranger than fiction. I can guarantee you that. And unless you've walked a mile in those shoes, you would not believe what the depravity of some people are capable of. It's just mind blowing. And then when you realize that how many people are actually capable of that, like I would never bring most of these experiences home to my family. I would never tell them what I saw, or it was just like, it was unbelievable. And so I write fantasy, I think maybe as an escape, but I wrote fantasy long before I joined the police service. But even when I was in the police service, I couldn't write because I was too stressed at that point. But the only time I could do it right was we had an hour unpaid lunch, and I would just jump into the lunchroom and throw my headphones on and eat and escape into my books. And so that's the only writing I did for 12 years was during my hour lunches. But it's neat. I should have probably wrote down some of the things I saw, but what do I want to write about them? I don't think you'd believe me. You would think that I'm so far-fetched when I was writing that there's no way any of this stuff could happen. So, yeah.
I'm sure.
Well, I don't know. These days, after the last few years, I think they'd believe almost anything. I can say that almost every week. I go, what? How can that be? That's crazy.
Yeah, you'd be surprised. You just can't dwell on it because it's just you lose faith in the human race.
I see that because I think that's kind of another issue with the internet, and that people are seeing others much easier. We're seeing a lot more of the weird and the wing nuts doing stuff. Yeah, and you're kind of like, I can't believe it, right? And you don't realize. And I think it's always been there. It's just we've got a lot bigger access to it, right?
Yeah, and you know what? And it's unfortunate, but I think a lot of it is, you know, as much as I enjoy wine and rum and coke, a lot of it's drug and alcohol. I would say pretty well 99% of it or more is driven by one or the other. And we had every day, like I worked in the court system, so we had one day devoted just to drugs. So any drug offenses and people overnight doing whatever crimes they came in as well. But it was all devoted to drugs. And someone came up to me one day and said, we should have an alcohol day. And I looked at him, I said, sir, the other 4 days are devoted to alcohol. Like it's true. Like no normal, sane person would do what these people do. So as much as you can't excuse what they've done, there is a reason that they do it. And when you work that profession, it's a hard line because you deal with these people all the time. There's no respect, a lot of, the stuff that you deal with, but you have to try and see beyond that and see the human element. And at one point you would hope that they weren't like that. Something in life got them to that point. And then it's just up to you. Can you make a difference? Can you maybe guide them back to living a regular, normal, productive life? Or are they a lost cause? There were a lot of lost causes I dealt with. I just shook my head and thinking, why did we bother with some of these people? But there were other people that we dealt with. You could see that there was something behind those eyes. There was, there was a spark of hope in there somewhere. And that's where, as a system, sometimes we fail. We just let them keep going.
Yeah, it's unfortunate.
Mm-hmm. Oh, for sure. There's no
magical. You know, and when you say that, running, on your lunch break and stuff, you'd headphone and write and stuff. So that leads me to the question of how do you plan your day in the sense of writing? It sounds to me like your emotion or your mood is very important, because let's say, the wife is working and you've got a certain amount of time, so, 4 or 5 hours here to write. Can you just kind of go, oh, I'll sit down and write? Or do you have to be in that mood?
I guess I have to be in the mood to write for sure. I don't believe in writer's block. That's brought up in a lot of writer's circles. I got writer's block. I think a story will write itself and it's ready to write itself. And I think what we do as authors is we stress over the fact that we're not writing today. And I do as well. And we think that we got writer's block. No, you don't have writer's block. You just, the story's not ready to write itself. When your mind is developed enough with that, with the story, it will all of a sudden come out. At least that's my experience. As far as the writing life, my wife and I, we work from home and we work in the same office, and it actually works out quite well. She leaves me alone. I leave her alone. I wake up in the morning. I deal with social media, Facebook mostly, but try and get in touch with my fans. arrange things like this with the interview with you guys. And at some point I will edit what I wrote yesterday. So if I write 2,500 words today, I will edit that tomorrow morning. And that puts me in the frame of mind to start writing again at somewhere around lunchtime. Just after lunch, I will sit down and I'll write for 2 to 3 hours. I might get 500 words out. I might get 3,000 words out. And by supper time, I just shut it down. And I generally don't write after supper. So I've got it, even though I write full time, I probably only really write 2 hours, 2.5 hours.
Don't let your wife hear that.
Oh, no, she knows. No, she knows. She's a big supporter. She understands the process, yeah. There's so much other things, especially as an independent author. There's so many things that are going on. I'm wearing so many hats, and she's trying to take over some of that so that I can, you know, focus on writing as opposed to trying to deal with social media or market myself or advertise all that stuff that I don't want to do.
Yeah, yeah, it's hard if to do all of that, the marketing and the. There's so many parts to writing books and series of books and getting it out there that, you know, it's a lot to learn.
Oh, for sure. And I'm admittedly not good at any of those. So I tell people that I think of myself as a race car driver. So I write the book, but without my team behind me, my pit crew, my book goes nowhere. So, you know, even though I'm the AJ Foyt, so I get all the glamour and the glory because I'm the author. My car would never cross that finish line if I didn't have my pit crew behind me. So I always try to give credit to them whenever I can because they're the ones that actually make my car go.
Well, you know, you mentioned, you know, only writing for like 2 or 3 hours. And, you know, I've noticed myself that when it comes to fiction, not so much nonfiction, but fiction, you know, you're so kind of locked into that world, so focused that, and I don't know if you feel the same way, but I feel that, you know, it to me, it feels like 2 to 3 hours is almost like, you know, writing for 6 or 7 hours, doing 6 or 7 hours worth of work is kind of how I feel after I've done like 3 hours of writing.
Yeah, no, I actually, my time flies when I finally get sink my teeth into what I'm doing for the day. All of a sudden I look back on the clock and go, wow, where'd the time go? It just takes me a while to ease into it. And once I'm in there, I need to be left in there. And the problem with working at home and other things going on is that you have things that, you know, pull you out of what you're doing. And COVID's been such a distraction with that. Like, you would think that COVID would, because we're just stuck at home now because of COVID, we're not going anywhere. I have so much more time to write. And it's not true because there's all these little things pulling at you to just pull you out of the moment. So once I get into the moment and once I get into the writing, time flies really quickly. I get a lot of words done. But as soon as something pulls me out, it takes me a while just to ease back in there and get my brain wrapped around what I'm doing again. So, but we're all different as writers, for sure.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, Dave's different.
Sorry, Dave, I didn't mean to bring that up.
Oh, that's okay. That's true, though.
So you said you like social media. So how do people find you? What social media are you on? Do you have a website? Do you have any sort of blogs or anything like that? What's the contact place for you?
Yeah, the best way, follow me. You can follow me. I'm on Facebook and I have an author page, my regular page. I just accept any friends. You know, I should say maybe advise one there. But just look for Richard A. Stevens. I think it's Richard Hugh Stevens 39. I don't know where the 39 came from, but and he was Stevens is S-T-E-P-H-E-N-S. He was H-U-G-H, but Richard Hugh Stevens 39, and you'll see a green dragon eye icon. I do most of my social media through my regular Facebook page. I do some of my more official stuff through my Facebook author page, and that's Richard Hugh Stevens again. My website. You can reach me through there is at www.richardhstevens.com. And again, Stevens is spelled with a PH. I normally just do Facebook myself. I'm on LinkedIn. I'm on Instagram. I'm on Twitter. I don't understand any of those platforms. That's where my wife steps in. She's a genius with all that stuff. So I've got no use for Twitter. I don't understand it. It makes no sense to me. I've got no Instagram. I'm certainly not a TikToker.
Oh, come on.
No. No, that's beyond me. I think I'm too old for that. I'm too set in my ways to do a TikTok. But so Facebook is my normal social media platform for sure. And as far as blogs and stuff, I actually host a show called Lurking for Legends every Tuesday night. And it's a play on my one series called Legends of the Lurkers. So now this one's Lurking for Legends, and that's my way to give back to the writing community for all the help. They've been so instrumental in helping me get my career up and running and off the ground, because there's so much to learn as an independent author that it's overwhelming. You just don't know where to start, so you don't start. But when you surround yourself with a bunch of people who are willing to help you, you know, it's not a competition being an author. It's all about supporting each other. And so Lurking for Legends airs every Tuesday on my Facebook page, my Facebook author page, from 8 till 9. And I talk to writers from and other people from different walks of the publishing industry. So narrators, cover artists, some kind of marketers. We have them on there every week. So.
Interesting. Now we're going to have all that up on our website as well. People can find you there.
Well, that'd be
great.
You
yes. have to know it's PH.
They get the PH in there for sure. And the H. A lot of people forget the H. And if you search Richard H. Stevens, you'll come up with 1,000 of them. So that H really helps to hone down.
Yeah, we've got another Richard Stevens on in 2 weeks.
Well, there you go.
3 weeks.
PH?
Yeah. Yeah, and I'm calling him Dick. Just so I can tell. I had to do everything because I was getting you guys mixed up. It's crazy. Okay. Have to be careful. Now, one book, if someone wants to never have heard of you before, which is really hard for me to believe, but if they didn't know who you were and they said, what one book should I get to find out what Richard H. Stevens with the PH sound is like, which one would you suggest they start with?
Well, we're really here to talk about the Highcliffe Guardians and Keeper of the Jewel, which is the series I'm writing now, but my best-selling book is Rika's Flight, and that's the one. It's about a six-year-old girl at the beginning of the book, and she's sitting on the side of a hill with her grandfather overlooking the ocean. And you know, she's very innocent, and she's pointing at different things, and she points at a butterfly and says, "Can I fly as high as a butterfly?" And of course, Grandpa's being what they are, he encourages her to do. You know, she can do anything she wants. And at some point, she says, "Can I fly as high as a dragon?" He says, "Of course you can." And then they go home, and Grandma finds out. And Grandma's not too happy that Grandpa's filling her head with all this stuff. And the story quickly evolves from there. And so it's all about a young girl who is kind of ostracized for her imagination and wanting to follow her dreams. And she gets bullied. And she quickly grows up in the story. So, you know, by chapter 3 or 4, she's 18 and then 19 and then 21. And then she's trained to hunt dragons because the king does not like that the dragons are higher in the food chain than man is. So he wants to eradicate the dragons from the land. And she believes that that's what they should be doing. But something happens in the story that changes that point of view. And she realizes that what they're doing to the dragons is wrong. And then Rika decides that she wants to champion the cause of the dragons. And it's all about her quest to save the dragons from the king. So it's a 3-book series. It's the Legends of the Lurker. And book one is Rika's Flight. And it won a couple of awards a couple of years ago. It's my best-selling book. And my wife, who doesn't even like fantasy, but she's one of my proofreaders, she absolutely fell in love with the story. So if anyone's to get in on the Soulforge universe, that's probably the book to start with.
Well, now we know, you know, we know all about Stephen. Richard
yes.
Stevens. He's a lurker.
Yeah. But you know what? Lurker is the name of the dragon, and the dragon is named after the cat. So, yeah.
Oh, well, there you go. See? Now you know a secret.
Yep. The dragon's named after the cat, and Rika was actually named after my wife and my daughter, so Rebecca and Caroline.
Wow. See? We find out all these.
Oh, there's so many things that I've got in there, for sure.
You must have. You're kind of a. Structured. I don't know how to say it. You sound like an alpha to me, but you're not. But you must have a lot of. I don't know. You must be really sensitive to write a lot of these stories.
Yeah, I would think I am. I think one of my own faults that I find is I have the inability not to tell the truth. So especially when I was in the work environment. People had asked me some hard-nosed questions, I would get myself in trouble by telling the truth. And it seems like a strange thing to say, but so yeah, I feel I'm as much as I don't wear my heart on my sleeve per se, I'm kind of reserved. I'm like my father that way, but he was a very emotional man, and you could see it once you understood who he was. And you know, I think I get a lot of that from him. I empathize with everyone. You know, I can see the good and the bad in everybody. Working in the police service really brought that out, especially that. It's funny because whenever I was in uniform, I always thought everyone I looked at was guilty of something. And as soon as I took the uniform off, you know, I just reverted back to normal where I didn't think that way anymore. So it's funny how certain things shape or color your views on things. But yeah, I would say I'm deep inside, I'm very emotional for sure.
Yeah, and it's and the things we do, things like what you said, when you're looking for crime and you're an officer, it must somewhat jade you towards people.
Oh, for sure.
And so when you have some years of doing that and seeing all of these bad things day after day, it must kind of creep into your thoughts in the sense that you're always on guard of these bad things happening. And that's sort of maybe where it kind of starts at when you create a story.
Yeah, like I say, I started the policing career later on in life, so I'd done a lot of writing before then. But it's funny that you mentioned that. I remember the first few months of working in the policing industry, I guess they call it industry, working in the policing environment. Yeah, I'm an author and I can't come up with the right word. Working in the environment, and I remember one officer looking at me, and I was being too emotional, I guess, for what was going on. I was being too sympathetic to the criminal. And of course, it bugged the officer I was working with. And he said, don't worry. He says, one of these days you will be broken. He said, and you'll know it when it happens. And I had no idea what he was talking about. And then you deal with these people time and time again, and you try to give them the benefit of the doubt. And then, you know, they cut your throat, so to speak. They stab you in the back as soon as you got your back turned. And I'm talking about the criminals now. And all of a sudden, one day, I was jaded. I just knew it. It was almost like someone hit a switch. And all of a sudden, I lost my empathy for a lot of these people. And that was scary because, like I said earlier, that I don't think any of us actually are born mean or evil. You know, things in the environment have beaten us down or changed us or done something negative towards these people to get them to be where they are. A bad choice. There's so many people I saw in the policing industry that, you know, grade A student and everything else went to a party one night and got hooked on something just because, you know, they had a couple of drinks or something and someone pushed something on them. And next thing you know, they're stealing from the family and then they're stealing from society. Then they're on the streets and you got this beautiful girl who was 16 years old, had her whole life ahead of her. Now she's working the streets in Toronto and, you know, she'll probably die before she's 30. And to see that, because we do lineups and we do photos and fingerprints and everything else of these people and just normal people, and you know, when a kid looks like a kid, 10 years later, they look like they're 80 years old because of what drugs have done to their skin and everything, their teeth and all. It's just, but as an officer, all of a sudden you just get jaded to these people, and because you know they're going to try and stab you in the back, and it's unfortunate because they all aren't like that. But you, as an officer, you have to see them all like that because I don't want to get into the political part of the whole thing about the shootings and stuff like that, but an officer's got to make a decision so fast that he can't stand back there and let you shoot him first. So at some point he's got to make the split second decision, and we can all in social media and in society judge him after the fact. But you know, really, how would you honestly react in some of these situations? You couldn't even say because you don't do it, but.
Yeah, no, it's
I'm not, really, defending some of the officers that have done some things that they shouldn't have. By all means, I'm not doing that. I'm not saying that everyone is good, but it's just so volatile. And you deal with these people every day and you think, oh, that officer, why is he so cranky? He just gave me a ticket and he's been mean to me. But you don't, you know, you probably didn't deserve the attitude the officer gave you, but the stuff that he went through coming up to that point in that day, and he's just trying to get through the day, and, you know, we all want to go home. I don't go to work hoping that someone's going to punch me in the face, but that's what these people face every day. And does that justify them being, you know, kind of short with you when they're giving you a traffic ticket? Well, probably not, because you're human too, and you've done nothing wrong other than just sped. But I think we all need to take a step back and just appreciate what everyone else goes through in life, and not just an officer, but anyone. Like, we all face our own little things. So.
Yeah, yeah, and we're all human, exactly. So we all do things, you know, and that. But so when you become jaded, I guess that's probably when you started going out and being a serial killer.
Yeah. Well, let's hope that doesn't happen. I haven't done that yet, so at least I won't admit to it.
Oh, come on. Let's get the real scoop here. No. Well, you're an interesting guy. I can't believe it. How do you like reviewers and ratings and the whole internet world now, and everyone having access to you, so to speak, you know, to say what they like or don't like? Do you sort of, are you okay with that, or do you not like it, or where do you stand?
Yeah, I'm starting to get a thick skin. Maybe the policing industry helped me do that as well. But I got a 1-star review, and it was the very first review on Soulforge. And this was the only review there. And this person had a bone to pick with anyone who wasn't Brandon Sanderson. For some reason, if you weren't Brandon Sanderson, you give him 1-star review. And then he said, you know, go read Brandon Sanderson. So, but that crushed me, because this is the very first book that third book I published, but it was the very real book, first book. This is one that I had in my head for 35 years. And I got that review, and I was just devastated. I'm thinking that, you know, if Alan or David go on Amazon, they don't know who I am, but they always an interesting cover, and they click on it to see one-star review. You're not going to waste your money on that book, right? Why would you? So you'd move on. And so I reached out to the author community, and they were amazing. And all of a sudden, a whole bunch of people put in some, you know, nicer reviews and stuff just to get the rating back up. But yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. It's hard. It is. It is. Well, you're an interesting fellow. It's been a good interview, and we thank you for taking the time, you know. And remember, everybody, you can go around Toronto there. You might see old Richard out there lurking.
Yeah, that's right. I might be lurking for, yeah. I hope to get there. There's big things there called Ad Astra and the Fan Expo and stuff like that. They're great big events. We don't do events as well as they do in the States, but they're the big ones in Toronto, so I'm hoping to get there this year.
Well, that'll be good. Yeah, I'm sure you'll do fine, dressed up like a dragon. And
tonight, yep. And
well, Richard, it's been a pleasure. And so now the book, of course, we were focusing on, that we didn't focus on a lot, but is Keeper of the Jewel, and it's book one. And our guest has been the author, Richard H. Stevens. Thank you for being here.
No, thank you for having me on. It's a pleasure talking to you both.
Thanks, Richard.
Tired of wasting time trying to decide what to watch on your streaming service? Go to our website and look for the Martino Movie Reviews.
To find out more about our show, guests, or to listen to past shows from our archive, please go to www.houseofmysteryradio.com.
Show's over for now.
Was it as good for you as it was for me?
Well, good night.
This has been a production of Something Weird Media.
I'll be back.
Step onto the legendary clay courts of Roland Garros, where the world's best players battle it out at the French Open for a chance to win a Grand Slam title. Tennis Channel Plus is your place to watch. Stream every court from your phone or smart TV live in HD. See the action unfold as legends fight for glory and new rivalries emerge. Daily live coverage begins Monday, May 20th, with match replays on demand so you never miss a moment. From the first serve to the final point, Roland Garros promises unforgettable moments and new chapters in tennis history. Stream now with Tennis Channel Plus to be there when it happens.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
You've been listening to the House of Mystery radio show. To find out more about our guests, hosts, or shows, go to www.houseofmystery.com.
Show is over for now.
Was it as good for you as it was for me?
Yeah. Good night.
This has been a production of Something Weird Media.
I'll be back.